Thanks for joining us. How much fun is this?
I've been worried about it all day.
You've been worried?
Yeah.
She's heard about you, Michelle. She's heard about your reputation.
I was more worried about Mike.
Oh, that one backfired.
Yeah, I'm not mean. Don't believe anything Mike said about me.
This is the West Coast Project podcast for Halt and Catch Fire. It might be the very, very last one. And we have a special guest with us this week, Michelle. First of all, hi, Michelle.
Hi, Mike.
Hey, we have Christine, our fan from the UK. Hi, Christine.
Hi, Christine.
I'm Mike. Hi, Michelle.
Hey, Christine kind of found us through our other podcast, the West Coast Project podcast for the Americans. Ironically, Christine, you're not in America. Tell everybody where you are.
I'm in the UK, Wales, UK.
Wales.
I'm actually in Cardiff Electrics.
Interesting. So the only person I know from Wales is Tom Jones. Who else
is
famous?
Well, there's lots of others.
Who else is
okay,
famous?
You got Matthew Rhys from the Americans.
Oh yeah, okay.
Okay, what's this? Oh, Shirley Bassey, Anthony Hopkins. Oh, we got hundreds of them. Catherine Zeta-Jones.
Michelle, do you have any special geographical questions about Wales?
Oh my gosh, Mike, you know, like, geography is like the worst. It's my worst. So I couldn't even ask an intelligent question.
Well, Christine, thanks for coming on the show. You don't have to feel nervous. We try to have one person outside of the regular people like Michelle and I, or Jamie and I, or Michelle and Jamie, just to add some interest other than us blathering on about our TV shows. So it's cool to have you on. You just started watching this show, right? Halt and Catch Fire?
Yeah, last week.
Yeah, she's been jamming them in, Michelle.
Wow, great job.
How many did you get to, Christine?
I've just started episode 2 of the second season.
Okay. That's cool. So it'd be cool just to hear your take on it. Michelle, this is episode 210, Heaven is a Place Where Nothing Ever Happens. Christine, you're just going to have to fight your way into this conversation because Michelle and I have already started other topics and things. But Michelle, your husband is a genius, but it looks like he was pretty wrong about what his take was on Cameron and Joe planning this disruptive virus.
Well, I don't think he thought Joe planned it with Cameron, but I think he thought as soon as he saw that little inscription when it came up on the computer, I think he thought that it was there. And yeah, it doesn't seem like it was from what they've told us yet anyway. It seems
he did not know it was a virus, and he was backslapped.
I don't trust him. You know, I don't trust him in that instance. Do you?
Yeah, I don't think he knew, and I think he felt backstabbed by it, and it got him embarrassed and in trouble, and it got his boss in trouble. And
yeah, but he was going to do it anyway. I mean, he wasn't going to obviously do that and add a virus to it, but he was going to take it down anyway. He was the one who stood there before the virus took over and said essentially it wasn't even theirs to do. So
no, I think he was just trying to give credit to Cameron.
He essentially said they stole it. That's what he said. And then, you know, it comes crashing down and he's all this, you know, indignation over everything.
That's different, like, though. That's way different than admitting the author of something is actually not yourself, it's somebody else. He was deflecting credit from himself to the true author. But to insert a virus and damage a company's assets like that, that's way different.
Oh, sure. One is like criminal and the other, or maybe anyway, and one's not. But I was just kind of... I think he felt used, assuming that he didn't know, and I do assume now that he didn't know, but I think he felt used by Cameron, and
well,
that's
he was.
Why he's
yeah,
so
totally.
Angry at Mutiny now. as we find out.
So, Christine, when you get to this point, this is obviously the end of season two. Now it's 210. So you'll see that things really develop a lot, through this season. It's actually a really good season. Michelle, what did you think of the overall tone of the season?
I have loved season two. And Christine, I'm so, you know, glad that you powered through season one. I thought season one was good, but it kind of, you know, I don't know, it kind of got boring a little bit in the middle, I thought. I hate to say that, but I promise you, if you get through season two, you'll really see that they were laying a whole lot of groundwork, I think, in season one for everything that's now happening.
There were a few things in season one, or a few scenes that made me, you know, when something really engrosses you and grabs your attention and you're watching, you think, oh, this is awesome. And then all of a sudden you find yourself looking at your phone or doing something else. And
absolutely.
There was a few times in season one that I thought that. But on the whole, I did like it. Joe is not my favourite person. I don't like Joe as a leading man, which seems he's just not my favourite person. I like Cameron, I like Gordon, I love John Bosworth.
Yeah.
I like all of them. There's just something, I don't know, when he stands looking out of that glass window in his tight white things, I just think, oh my God, you make me sick. I don't know what it is. And at the end of season one, I was really angry that he set fire to the whole lorry full of van, whatever you call them over there. He set fire to them and no one said anything the next day in the office. I was thinking, how strange, you know, that's really bizarre that nobody said a word. And it didn't explain that he took off.
Yeah, he took off to find his true love from college, Sarah. You'll see that coming up, as you probably already know from watching one or two of season two. I'm going to differ from you guys, though. I liked season one. A lot of people say season one was kind of ho-hum, but season two is awesome. I think season one was awesome, and season two was a continuation of it. And Joe is my favorite character of all the people.
Did you watch season one week to week, Mike, or did you power through it?
I powered through it.
Okay, I think That really may have something to do with it, because I watched it back when it was week to week. I watched it like that, and it was really hard, I felt like, to get what you needed. This, if I could have watched it back to back, I think I would have had it. Well, I mean, I have, because I went back and watched it again, and I really enjoyed it the second time. And I thought it might be because I knew so much about season two. But I really think now, especially hearing both of you talk about it, that it might be more just that I got to see it back to back. It was a difficult thing to watch on a weekly basis, for me anyway. Not difficult, but it just wasn't as compelling or engrossing as I would like. But for a first season, I mean, I thought it was good, and I really hope this show is not canceled. I'm going to be so sad if Halt and Catch Fire ends the way this last episode ended.
Yeah, it's very likely to be canceled. It has really low ratings, but it did. We'll get to it as we go through this episode, but the writers really did an excellent job of setting up season three if it ever has a chance, because there's a lot of stuff that would be interesting to see what happens.
I think in the middle of season one, it became amazing. It went from good to amazing. I fell in love with it more and more. So I didn't actually hate season one. I just didn't love it as much as towards the end of season one. Now I really like it.
Well, Christine, if you listen to this podcast after we record it, you're going to be spoiled. So I hope you can still enjoy season two. It's pretty cool. It's pretty fun what happens in season two. It's a great story. It just really is. It will be a shame if it gets canceled.
I'm fine. Once you've said it, I'll probably forget it anyway.
I don't think it'll spoil it anyway. This show is good. Each episode, almost, as long as you know these characters, is almost standalone. I mean, of course, there's parts that aren't, but it's so good, and the acting and stuff is so good and just interesting to watch. I don't really think it would spoil it. It wouldn't for me to hear what was going on, so I hope it doesn't for you.
Oh, no, I've got spoiled lots of times, so it won't bother me at all.
Okay, great.
So to start out, Joe's driving some old Jeep or some old 1985, whatever. He's driving along.
It's not his Porsche.
It's a what?
It's not his Porsche.
Yeah, definitely sold his Porsche to go to the show. Remember?
I do remember. I'm just saying, you know, it's definitely a contrast to what? To season one, episode one, when he's driving the Porsche and, you know, bursting into town. It was just like the complete contrast to that.
They also focus a lot on his ring, his wedding ring.
They do.
On the steering wheel, and then a couple other times with the holding the floppy disks and stuff.
Yep.
And we see interspersed with his driving this news about WestNet. The banks are frozen. The stock's down 7 or 8 percentage points, and it's lost $6 or 7 million in cost of the damages of this virus eating away the shareholders and the shareholders' value. Shareholders' faith in the company just crashes, and this.
I have a question about that, Mike.
Okay.
If you know, is this the increased value of the company based on community that they came up with, or is this the overall oil company? You know, I mean, did their price surge already because of community and then drop, or is this taken away from the overall, like literally dipping into the shareholders?
It's taken away from the overall. WestNet is just a division within West Group, so it's not like it's a new venture that added a bunch of money to the West Group.
Okay.
It's a new thing. It's a kind of a brand new thing. So West Group was introducing it. And when if you're introducing a technical feature to your company and the technical aspects of it cause everything to crash and lose stuff, it's just really, really bad. So it made West Group look bad from where it was before to have lost all that percentage and all that money from before.
Okay.
So they didn't come out even. They came out way behind.
Okay.
And Jacob looks like an idiot for introducing this technology before it's ready, or introducing a technology that's a total failure. And he even calls himself the scapegoat. They need a scapegoat. I guess it's me. So he's out. He gets nixed from the company because of all this. So we jump to Joe and his lawyer. Joe's going to sign dissolution papers to divorce himself, or I guess just not divorce, but dissolve the marriage. I guess people that are married might know how that works better than I do, but I guess within a certain period of time, you can just dissolve the marriage if it's close enough.
I think that's just a divorce. I think that's just the legal jargon for divorce. I could be totally wrong. I'm sure somebody will let me know if I am, but I think it just means divorce.
Well, over here, if you're separated, you stay apart for 2 years, your marriage can just get dissolved then. But dissolved usually means that you get served a decree nisi, or that's what we call it. I don't obviously don't know your laws.
Well,
go on.
If you're on Breaking Bad, dissolved means something entirely different.
I've never watched Breaking Bad.
Christine, you haven't?
No,
oh my
goodness. I've got so much stuff to watch. I've got old shows streaming, and I'm lost myself. I never used to watch this much television.
Yeah, that one, Michelle's right. That one should be on the top of your list.
Yes, bump everything down and watch Breaking Bad. But make sure you've got the time to do it, because you cannot turn them off in between one and the other. It is top-notch TV. You loving the Americans will love Breaking Bad.
I loved Mad Men. I loved the Americans as one of my top shows. Vikings. I have so many shows I've forgotten. I watch stupid shows as well for light relief. Under the Dome, Rain. I can't even remember half of them now.
Yeah,
I've got a site that I can.
That's pretty light. It's pretty light. The *Halt and Catch Fire* was the replacement show for *Mad Men*, and if you look at it thematically, it's got a lot to do with *Mad Men*. You've got the dashing, debonair lead male character, and well, they do. It does.
Yeah, yeah, I know, but
yeah, he is a little bit Don Draper.
I mean, Don Draper had a lot of evil, dark sides to him.
Mm. Yeah, but Don Draper was a whole lot easier to like, I think, than Joe is.
Joe gets easy to like in this episode, though. Joe is – I like what they're doing to Joe to make him not just a shady shyster of a character. He's become pretty complete in this, at least especially through this episode.
Yeah, but Mike, he flip-flops. He is the opposite, or not the opposite, the exact, like, I don't know, to Cameron. He's good or he's bad, and it's like there's no in-between. He's
all right,
like,
Donna.
Well, he is. He's, like, beaten down. He's, like, either beaten down and contrite, or when he comes back, he's just, like, stepping all over everybody to come back. It's like he doesn't learn a lesson ever.
Not in this one, though. He tried to give Gordon credit, tried to introduce this idea with...
Oh, come on. I know, but then he gets, like, pissy because Gordon says he's going to work for Mutiny, and that's just it.
Yeah, because they just stabbed him in the back. He's like, you're going to work for the company that stabbed me in the back?
I know, but Gordon... I mean, Joe can't expect Gordon to sit around and wait on him either. I thought that was a real great part of this episode, though, but we're way ahead of ourselves.
All right, so Joe, sorry, Christine, Joe it's signs fine. These dissolution papers, and we start to see what they're doing at Mutiny, some more new stuff at Mutiny. They're doing, like, graphic visualizations, like people have little animes of each other.
And yeah, this is where Cameron has finally put her genius, is how I took it anyway, into community in place of just into the games. And so it really becomes much more interactive. And I loved everything she was doing. I could see how that would be so appealing back then.
She even says at some point there is no more game part of Mutiny. So, but one cool thing is just a smart business thing she does is the more time that you spend online, the more options you have to add to your anime and your character. That is really smart. So she's been innovative all along, but yeah, you're right. She's kind of let the games part of it go. But they still have server issues. They still have this problem with the server. They're getting charged more and more because they have more traffic, and they need their own metal. They've decided we need to get our own metal and get out of this loop of people just having us at their mercy. And that's an integral part of this strategy of this episode.
Okay, is that common? Is that the natural progression of the next step, or is this something that Cameron is just fighting for in her Cameron wild card kind of way? Do you know?
Well, both. She wants to buy a server, and a good server is $1 million, which they don't have. But she's onto something pretty smart, is that if you own your own, you know, like if you have Comcast for your network, you can rent their router, or you can just go out and buy your own for $40, and that's it. You have it. They don't charge you $6 a month,
right?
So that, on a little tiny scale, that's what she's saying, is let's just buy our own, and we won't be at the mercy. People can't raise their rates or tell us that we're not a customer anymore. Or shut us down. They own their metal. They own their own control of it. But
she's pretty forward thinking, certainly, but.
Her eyes are
ahead of herself.
She is ahead of herself. Her eyes are way bigger than their wallet. They don't have the money to buy a. I mean, the whole analogy of the submarine, and you want to ride in a submarine, you got to join the Navy and salute some guys that you don't want to salute every now and then. You can't just buy your own submarine.
It'd be cost effective for them to buy their own server. Lots of companies, you know, even in the 80s, had to then buy their own server. So Cameron. Realistically, if we think about Cameron, she invented online gaming. Cameron reminds me of how Google started somewhere in some little poxy flat, sat somewhere. They're all playing games. It just reminds me of Google.
Yeah, I think that's the intention, that she's, you know, they're representing innovative people from the mid-80s, early 80s. So.
Yeah.
So did answer your question, Michelle?
Yes, I think so.
Okay, so Yo-Yo pops up and says, we've got 29 signups in the 703 area code, so that's Houston. So it's pretty good in pretty short time.
It shows us he's back. He did come back. You were right, Mike.
Well, yeah, he showed up at the party. But that's the scale companies were at that point. If you get like 8 new signups, 8 people signed up, 29 people signed up, it's like a huge – that's a monumental moment in the growth of the company.
And I thought about that, and they were talking about that in relation to and right up against a $1 million server. And I remember how expensive it was to be online. Of course, it wasn't in the 80s. It was in the 90s, I guess. But still, 29 people and then $1 million server. I mean, it was just like, it was kind of like what you said. That is, if that was a big deal and everybody's cheering 29, that really does kind of take us back to what it was like back then.
And then we see the geek accountant that reminds us that Tom's not there anymore. He wants his desk because it has two drawers.
Well, he fits in nicely.
Christine, did you watch this episode? Did you watch 210?
No.
Okay.
It's not spoiling it, though. You're okay.
Okay. And then more of Joe not looking back. I remember we talked about this last week, Michelle, how Joe literally looked back over his shoulder at Jacob as he was being, or maybe 2 weeks ago, I can't remember, but as he was being forced out of the company. Mm-hmm. He just signs that divorce decree, dissolution document, and just whatever. Okay, I'm signing it. I wanted to talk to her first, but he didn't think about it. He signs it and it's done with.
Well, I mean, you have to, don't you? I mean, he's come to that point. I guess he could fight it legally or something, but they were married, what, for a hot minute at best. And, I mean, what can he do? I felt like he really didn't want to. I felt like they're showing his ring and he's, you know, massaging the ring and everything. I mean, he wanted that relationship.
So, spoiler alert, Christine, Sarah and Joe get divorced.
Well, spoiler alert, they get married.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, they may not even be married by the time.
Well, he's proposed to her, and he's met her father, who is obviously a millionaire. Joe's going to do something, mess that up.
Yep, you'll see. Just saw Jacob Wheeler, that's Jacob. Yeah. All right, so we go to Gordon's group, his therapy group for his psychology problem. And they keep stress notebooks, Michelle. On Gordon's stress level is a 0.28. Of course, the engineer that he is, he's broken it down into a 2-degree fraction.
He's just being a smart aleck, you know? He's such a smart aleck. He's hard to like in this. He is. I'm really having Gordon problems.
I like Gordon in this one. I didn't like the woman who had like a 78 stress level because her bus route changed and the new Kmart is farther away and the just petty crap that she is forcing herself to be stressed about. Even the counselor cut her off.
Yeah. I mean, that was, but I think it was just showing us that other people's stress may not be your stress or whatever, but, or in this situation, but Gordon's is in comparison to other people's being between 20 something and 50 something or whatever. And Gordon's is a 0.28. I mean, he's just being a smart aleck. He's just like playing. It's a game to him. And I understand he's smart and everything, but it's, I don't know.
Well, he's trying to tell the counselor that I have no stress. I don't want to be here and I shouldn't be here. And the counselor's trying to tell the other woman, look, you're exaggerating a little bit. He cuts her off. He doesn't even let her keep going about these petty things. And he tries to engage Gordon, like, come on, it can't be that little. It can't be 0.28. What are you really worried about? And gets him to play act all that stuff. And you're right, Gordon's he's fighting it. He's not doing enough. He's not participating. And Donna sees it.
What he ended up saying, did you hear? Because he really did end up kind of confessing about it. His 0.28, Christine, came from him being unable to find his eyeglasses one morning. And I mean, he's just being a smart aleck and everything. And so then they say he keeps asking him questions about it, this counselor does. And he ends up finally coming back and saying that he was stressed because he doesn't know if he just misplaced his glasses or if it's his brain problem. And I don't even know if you know about the brain problem. I don't think Christine knows. Do you?
I, to be honest, I didn't need to be told. I've just worked that out myself that he's got a problem. He's been having, besides the nosebleed he's just having from cocaine,
right.
I kind of knew that there was something wrong with him because even in season one where he was digging the hole and he was looking for the giants, I thought this guy has seriously got a problem.
Yes.
He's got a physical problem from the solder and the way that he used to build with chips and being the lab and the hardware and stuff. He's got a physical problem that's like damaged his brain. They find that out. But then they find also, in addition to that, that that's triggered the knowledge to everybody that he has this emotional problem, that he's psychologically damaged some way too.
Okay.
So he got two problems in addition to just maybe being an addict with alcohol and cocaine. We're starting to see the psychological problem being dealt with here, though. That's why he's in this group. So his stress is he's making fun of the group. He doesn't want to be in the group, but Donna sees it and in that he's making fun of this whole group and the whole process. And I don't think Donna's really done with him, Michelle. I think she's genuinely interested in him. They make it kind of look like, hey, I might be done with this. I might be moving on. But she's really not. You can see in her eyes she really still cares about him. She's looking through that window at him.
I think Donna's on her last leg with Gordon. I think Gordon really better straighten up. I think there needs to be something's going to have to change. Even the way this episode ended, I still think Gordon is treading on the thinnest of ice. But that's just my take on it.
And then Joe does his death drive. That was really stupid, I thought.
Oh, it was. It was Paul on the motorcycle, right? In True Detective, it was the same thing.
Yeah, Christine, he's driving along on the highway at highway speeds, and he shuts his eyes, takes his hands off the steering wheel, Joe does, and just holds his hands and his hands away from the steering wheel and his eyes closed for, what, maybe 8-10 seconds, and somebody beeps the horn and he comes back to his senses and goes right back to controlling the vehicle.
He's dead.
No, he's not dead. He's just,
no.
He just...
No, I said he's a dick.
Oh.
Okay, is he being reckless there? Is he just saying nothing matters to him? Is Joe just an adrenaline junkie? Is this something he's needing to feel alive since he signed this divorce paper stuff? I didn't really get that scene.
I think it's okay, fate. What are you going to do with me? I put my hands in your control. And he just, because he doesn't steer into a wall like he's a suicidal guy. He's kind of like, okay, what's going to be next? Where's fate going to take me? And he kind of leaves it up for, it's a gamble, you know, it's a chance.
Well, take your foot off the gas or at least, I mean, that's not fate if your foot's on the gas. I don't know. I hate that. I didn't like that.
So that was it. There's the first commercial break. Now, is this the break, Michelle? I got my notes all out of order again. Is this the break with The Walking Dead? Fear the Walking Dead.
That's not where I have it, but I'm not even sure I wrote it down.
All right, well, I'll talk about it now. It's just this really cool commercial for Fear the Walking Dead comes on either here or somewhere else later. But it's the shot of nighttime Los Angeles with the time-lapse photography, and then the energy starts to fail, and the lights start going out in the buildings, and all but on one block where the fires on that block spell out the word fear. I mean, that show just looks awesome.
It looks great.
It looks like they've learned everything that they need to the highest level of expertise on the technology and the fear and the coolness and the style. I mean, that city going out like that is just so cool. I don't know. I can't wait to see what that show's going to bring us.
Me too. Are you excited about it, Christine?
Totally. I'm a Walking Dead nutcase. I'm in love with Rick. End of story. Rick and Ragnar Lothbrok from Vikings.
And who?
Ragnar Travis Fimmel from Vikings.
Oh, Vikings. Yeah, lots of women like that guy. He's got the look of like almost Jax on Sons of Anarchy.
Definitely.
They look like twins.
Somebody said before that they were distant cousins. I don't know how true that is, but he's definitely like Sons of Anarchy.
Yeah, that guy's British too. What's that guy's name?
Oh, I know I should know this.
Anyway.
My son watches never mind.
So we come back to Halt. The girls are eating breakfast and throwing waffles around, Michelle. Did your girls do that in your kitchen?
No. No. That was pretty bad.
They want Gordon's cooking. They don't like Mama. For some reason they're mad at Donna and they want Gordon's cooking.
Well, the inside of their waffle was still frozen, so that's pretty bad.
Well, Donna, what's happened to her household skills?
She should have you be... ever tried to, like, toast those little Eggo waffles? It is hard to get the inside... Just as an aside, it is hard to get the inside of those waffles toasted and nice and hot without burning the outside like a crisp. So I feel for Donna in that, but the kid throwing the waffle was too much. Sorry.
How about you, Christine? Can you cook waffles?
We don't eat waffles.
Okay.
I think we have different foods over here. We can buy them, and you would put them in the oven, but... we don't make them.
That settles that. Waffles are hard to cook. I just thought you just grilled them or toasted them and they're brainless.
You can buy a waffle maker. I've seen waffle makers. I'm sure some people like waffles, but they're our waffles, a potato. Is that what they are?
No.
Oh, no. No, no, no. It's like a bread product. It's
like
sweet
pancakes.
Bread. Yeah.
Oh, no, no, no. We make pancakes.
Waffles are essentially pancakes with squares in them.
Oh, no. Well, yeah. Our waffles are plain. They're kind of potato. They are potato. I don't eat them. I don't know.
But waffles that you make in, like, a waffle iron are really, really good. They're like pancakes, but they're, like, with a crunchy coating on the outside, kind of, and they're really good. Waffles that you buy pre-made in a box, it is not the same. But they are hard to toast, so... That was actually real.
Charlie Hunnam, by the way, is Jax Teller.
I was just going to tell you that, actually.
Sorry. All right, so let's get back to the show besides waffle recipes and Charlie Hunnam.
I know, because we're waffling.
All right. We need the rim shot. Okay, so the girls now spill to Donna that something came up in California. So Christine, Gordon took the girls to California to visit his brother. Who, by the way, Michelle, did you know that his brother was Kenny from Breaking Bad?
I think I did.
He was the guy. Was one of the Nazis, Kenny?
Yes.
But he took the girls to California, and he had a fight with his brother, and they found out about it through the girls. Just told Donna this at this breakfast where they threw the waffle. So Donna's eyes pop up on that, like, wow, there's more of a story about California that I don't know about. Do you think that was that ominous at this point, Michelle, that they had a fight and they went to a motel room? Do you think that was a really big deal to Donna at this point?
Yeah, I don't think it would have been such a big deal if he had told her. But the fact that he didn't tell her and the fact that the girls felt like they couldn't tell her, yeah, that would definitely set off some red flags to me.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's like secret.
Sure.
So Joni ends up, she's going to run away pretty soon, but I guess there's a fight before that happens.
Yeah.
So Joe goes into the VC guys, the Stokes financing company for the venture capitalist guys, and they're just playing him, Michelle. They're there to see the little clown act that they think Joe is and watching a psychopath. And he's selling them on this network idea, and the guy just says, there's no money for you here, dude. I just called you in here so we could watch you jump and dance. And there's a pretty big business lesson here, I think, Michelle. I don't know if you like this scene or not, but I really did. That Joe just stands up and walks away. And the lesson I think I got from this, there's no revenge, there's no payback in any of this. Like, he should be really mad at these guys. It's just cold-blooded numbers and strategy. Because even after this humiliation, he's going to go back to this guy for more money. But he should be really angry and really embarrassed and really kind of pissed off at this guy. But he's not. He just stands up and leaves.
Oh, I think he is, though. See, I think he is really angry and embarrassed and pissed off. I think, you know, you learn as you get older, I think, that you don't heckle the guy with the microphone. And because they're the ones with the power. So... there was nothing Joe could do at that point. Joe was downtrodden, and he was asking for something, and there was nothing he could do at that point.
But it doesn't prevent him from saying, I'm never going to set foot in this building again. I'm going to give my chance for this opportunity to somebody else. He just knows that they're the best likelihood to finance him, and he goes right back to them. That's a pretty important lesson, I think.
Yeah, I don't know if he goes back to him for that reason, or if he goes back to him because Joe is going to one-up who he wants to one-up. He's going to show these people. I think it's more arrogance than it is even business savvy, because what he ends up taking back is a slam dunk, and he knows it. He sees it, and it's just an arrogant move. It's like, I'm going to show you that I win.
I don't think so. I think he goes back to them because it's the best business strategy, because they're going to benefit. Their $10 million is going to be worth multiples more, because it is a good idea.
Sure.
He doesn't take his good idea somewhere else. He takes it to the best place, the most likely place for it to move into a real business. And that was the same guys.
Is this the only like lending company in town in all of, like, you know, where are they? They're like Dallas, Fort Worth, right?
Yeah, they're venture though. They're not just like a bank where you go to any bank and ask. They're like they put risky money up. But anyway, so he's humiliated at this point. He has to just stand up and leave. But he doesn't even swear, or, you know, well, fuck you guys then. He just leaves. Cameron wants to buy a submarine. It's brilliant. This is brilliant. Donna, she's pushing Donna's limits. She doesn't give up. And Donna says, this is an interesting idea, but there's absolutely no way we can afford it. And Cameron remains undaunted by this. She's just like, okay, I'll go back to my office and go back to work. But that idea doesn't leave her. Donna doesn't shut it down on her. She just has to think of another way to convince Donna to do it.
Yep.
I like that about Cameron in this little scene. All right, Luckenbach, Texas, the Gordon's Garage. Did you like the music in this one, Michelle?
Yes, I did. I really did. Of course, you know, growing up in the South, I grew up with that kind of music. So
I can't remember. Did you say you didn't like Gordon, or you did like Gordon in this one?
I'm finding it harder and harder to like Gordon. Honestly,
I like Gordon a lot in this one. Gordon's arc is very sad, because he seems like he's a truly happy soul, just burst trying to get out. but he kind of gets in his own way a lot, and he has all these medical challenges and now maybe mental challenges. But he's trying to get out. He's trying to be a happy person. He's trying to.
No, Gordon's weak, and he makes excuses for everything, and he puts out fires in place of handling his life and stuff. I don't know. I liked Gordon at the beginning, but I don't know. More and more, I'm just sensing a weakness in him. And it's
he's exuberant. He's in his garage. He's going to set up his little train set, and he's playing this pretty happy music. He's like bright Saturday morning or whatever it is. It just seems like he's enthusiastic about life, even with all this stuff around him. I don't know. I admired that about him. I think he was facing the challenges finally, and he wants Joe to be happier. He sees Joe. Joe comes up to the garage, and Joe hands him this little icon that's pretty important to Joe. But he sees Joe's unhappy, and he doesn't like that. It makes him feel bad, and he wants Joe to feel better. I like Gordon. I wanted him to win, and I liked him in this scene.
Okay, that part I agree. I do appreciate his wanting to fix the Joe thing. I think that's admirable. But it kind of goes back to what I said. It's just, he just wants to put out fires. It's like he doesn't want to handle things as they come up, but when or as they're going on in life. But when a problem happens, then he kind of steps up to the plate, which is okay, I guess. I mean, I'm sure that's how a lot of people do live their lives, but he seemed much more on top of everything before. And it just feels weak to me.
Well, he started two companies. He started Symphonic, and then he started the custom computer company. And he's faced some challenges. You know, I think he's – I don't know. I just see him differently. I liked how the train – he pulls out these model trains, Christine, he's going to set up in his garage. And I liked how the Luckenbach, Texas song synced up. The line about the trains kind of synced up with him pulling those little cars out of the boxes for the trains.
Mm-hmm.
That was pretty cool.
Okay.
And Joe shows up and gives him the prom chip from the earlier season one, actually. It's the memory chip that can be programmed one time, and it had the BIOS code. And Joe uses this little chip. It's a silicon chip, Christine, if you can picture the inside of a computer. It's about the size of like a poker chip, Michelle. Mm-hmm. And it's a touchstone that Joe uses whenever he feels down. He uses this chip to remind him of all this, you know, all the possibilities and all the accomplishments and stuff. But he wants to give it to Gordon, I guess, because Joe knows now that Gordon's got these medical problems, right, Michelle?
Well, I mean, I think he suspects. I don't know. Does he know?
He's going over there to give Jordan support. That he's not working Gordon here. He's there to just say, hey, take this. I'm thinking about you, and maybe this can help you like it helped me.
Yeah.
So he knows something's not good going on with Gordon, and he wants him to feel better and encourage him. He wants to give him encouragement. I don't know. I like this. I like this little touchstone and offering him hope and how it helps.
You see,
him.
I was afraid that it was almost like an instance where if somebody's going to off themselves, they give away their possessions and stuff. Or if somebody's dying, they give away their possessions. That's what I was feared with Joe.
Remind me not to watch TV with you, Michelle.
How come?
Thinking everyone's going to die.
Oh, I know. I mean, I've just been worried about them. You know, you never know where this is going to take them in this situation. But yeah, I guess I am kind of dark.
I don't think lead man is going to die yet.
No.
He may never die.
No, well, yeah.
Heaven, they're in heaven, a place where nothing ever happens. So Gordon offers to help correct the Sonaris problem that he's pretty much the author of, and Joe just walks away. Joe doesn't want anything from Gordon here. I think he just wants to offer this little monument of hope to Gordon.
Yeah.
And I don't think he's got ulterior motives. He just walks away. So we go to Mutiny, and the boys in Mutiny are making fun of a server that's become available in Dallas, right on the loop there in Dallas. It's a 3081 server, only $1 million.
Yep.
And they're kind of making fun of it. And then the other guys come in, and they relate the story of the night before where they were out with Tom, or they saw Tom Rendon, and how he was at a jukebox and kind of making fun of Tom Petty and talking to girls, or how he liked Tom Petty or something, but something to do with girls at a nightclub. And Cameron overhears it, and she doesn't want to hear Tom being anywhere but with her.
Yep.
And she doesn't want to hear it. Did you like that scene, Michelle?
Yeah, I thought that was really good. I heard her just, you know, kind of breaking her ear, trying to listen to every little nuance she could about Tom, because they're just showing us that she still has this. She still likes Tom.
Has Tom made his appearance, Christine, in episodes 1 and 2 yet, in season 2?
Not that I can recall.
He's the kid who rides up on his bike, and you'll see him pretty soon. But he's a romantic interest of Cameron's. But, Michelle, I didn't like this, because I thought she was done with Tom. Tom can't keep fading and flaring up and fading and flaring up. It just doesn't make sense. Is it just Cameron needing someone, and now she doesn't have Joe, so she needs Tom back?
Well, I think it's kind of the synergy of Joe and Sarah, because we see that with the exact same thing with Joe and Sarah is kind of what we've seen on the opposite end with Cameron and Tom, the ins and outs of Joe and Sarah and the ins and outs of Cameron and Tom. And I think where it's leading us, if it can, if they're given a chance, is a reconnect with Joe and Cameron. That's,
I know, but we've been through that.
Well, I know, but what else would they be showing?
I mean, that's why I don't get it. It's like Tom, it's heartbreaking that he's not on the plane,
is it? Yeah, that's the question. Why the whole Joe and Sarah thing, off and on, and then, you know, this flourish of him signing his name and it's done, and so maybe this is the flourish of Tom being really done. I don't know. I really see some parallels in those two separate, you know, romantic involvements.
So we go to Gordon and Donna. This is their fight now. This is a pretty interesting scene. He's reading a magazine article about Jacob Wheeler's dismissal from West Group. And their fight starts. Gordon is starting to be impressed that his virus is famous. He thought he'd be famous for something, but he didn't know it would be this virus. And Donna kind of just stops him, tells him to stop reading that. Did you take your medication? And he tells her that Joe came over. And Donna, we just find out, Donna just loathes Joe. She hates him. She doesn't understand him anywhere near the level that Gordon understands Joe. And I don't think a lot of people do. I think a lot of people are like you guys. They hate Joe. But they don't see all of Joe. Gordon sees more of Joe than a lot of the other characters in this series.
Okay, I don't hate Joe. I waffle on Joe.
No, I agree. I don't hate, don't hate anyone. I dislike the character at times. There's been nice moments with him and Cameron and him and Gordon, him and Tom. I've liked a lot of scenes. And he's great at what he does as the character, being creative and seeing the vision ahead and not just, you know, he's not the engineer, no. But without him, they wouldn't have got as far. He's a good visionary.
Well, absolutely. And without him, we wouldn't even really have the show. I mean, what would be the point of everything? He's the one who gets in there and stirs everything that goes on. Joe pretty much.
Well, we know he's an important character, but a lot of people do hate him. Donna hates him.
I don't understand Donna's hate for him.
Because she doesn't know him. She just thinks he's a user and he's a manipulator, puller of strings. She doesn't see him walk up and hand this little icon to Gordon. She doesn't see them hug. Gordon knows Joe better than any of the other characters in this show. And she doesn't see...
But then Gordon doesn't tell... Sorry. Gordon doesn't tell Donna anything either.
Yeah, no. Gordon and Donna have communication problems.
Sorry, I interrupted.
No, that's fine. That's your job. Yeah. So we're going to hear about these problems too in this. I got the feeling I'm going to line up on Gordon's side against you two guys with Donna here, but let's go through what happens.
I did want to point out before you go any farther that he's never seen Joe like this, and he's afraid too that Joe's going to do something desperate. So, you know, even Gordon thinks that Joe behaving the way he's behaved is so out of character that he fears for Joe at this point.
Yeah. I mean, we're going to review this coming up as we review season one, Michelle, but I like the scene with Joe and Donna and the kids. That was a really cool scene. When the rain, he told the kids how to fend off the thunder and lightning with the flashlights.
Sure.
That was pretty cool.
Yeah.
I mean, that Joe's not totally evil. He's got some good things in him.
Yeah,
but anyway.
Because he saw that... Can I interrupt a sec? He saw that the children loved the fact that they gave that... What you call them, flashlights? We call them torches. They gave their torches names, and he kind of got where Cameron was coming from then. That part I did like about Joe, that he saw ahead then, and it all clicked into place of what Cameron was trying to do, even though he didn't do it at the end in Vegas for her. I did like that scene.
Yeah, that was brilliant writing. He sees children giving personalities to tech, just simple, stupid technical things like a flashlight or a torch, and they have a personality and a name now, and that's exactly what Cameron was doing. That was really cool writing, I thought.
Yeah.
But then we all like things like that, don't we? It's like we personalize our iPads, our phones, our computers, all of our little things. That sometimes even could be a stupid teddy I'll give a name to. You know, we all love to personalize things to make our own.
So Donna admits that she and Cameron together set up the virus.
Yeah.
So they pulled that trick behind Joe's back.
Yeah.
Together. It wasn't just Cameron. And she calls Joe toxic. She sarcastically remembers someone stealing Gordon's idea. Like Gordon had forgot about that. And Gordon was calling it stealing his idea. And she's like sarcastic though with Gordon about this. She's pretty mean to Gordon. I know she wants the light to go on for him, but she's not very supportive of him. She blames him for keeping his illness from her. She just seems full of toxic stuff, and she's spilling it all out more and more now. Like she's got this built up that she's got to kind of get out of her system in this fight.
Yeah, but see, I don't blame her for this, which is really funny, Mike, because normally I'm on the guy's side and you're on the girl's side. But I gotta tell you here, I don't blame Donna for this, because I felt like Donna has been, the woman is bent over backwards for this man, and she's just literally at the end of her rope. And so then when she confesses that, about that it was her and Cameron, he's like, "Who are you?" And she's like, "Well, who are you?" You know, I mean, he's so quick to jump on her. And I mean, that was a big deal, but he's so quick to jump on her. And it's like he never gives her the benefit of the doubt. And she always gives him the benefit of the doubt. And it's just, I think she's just at the end of her rope.
Well, she blames him for keeping secrets and keeping the illness secret and all this from him. That's one of her major points here. But what about her abortion? That's still,
oh, I know.
That's a secret. She has an abortion, Christine, and she doesn't tell Gordon any of this, and she's blaming him for all these secrets he's keeping. So
yeah, but I mean, come on, she had an abortion while he was out having an affair, you know. So I mean,
doesn't matter. She can't be that proselytizing about secrets while she has this huge one of her own.
Well, he has the affair secret at this point.
Doesn't make her right, though.
No, it doesn't. But it doesn't make her, it doesn't make him any better.
I'm not trying to say he's better. I'm just saying she's making such a huge, heavy point about keeping secrets while she has one of her own. It's hypocritical.
Abortion's a touchy subject. I mean, it's a woman's choice. I know it's his child, presumably. I haven't watched this season, but abortion is just too, maybe it was just too much for her at that moment.
Well, actually, it's Joe's child. They have a lovely weekend.
No, it is not. No. Oh, my gosh. Don't do that to her.
All right. Well, she blames him.
I didn't think she would go near Joe.
She asks what happened in the hotel room, and he tells her of the affair. He blurts out the affair. He has an affair, Christine, with his brother's, actually, high school girlfriend. In one day, he has a one-day affair. And he tells Donna, and he says, "I did it because you didn't listen to me about my illness. You weren't there for me. Our marriage is broken."
See, that disgusted me with him. If you're going to do something like that and you're going to confess it, good, but don't say, "Because you weren't there for me. I looked for my marriage and I couldn't find it." That was the most unfair thing I've ever heard. And that was ridiculous.
Well, the way he blurted it out was bad, but it's pretty true, Michelle. She wasn't there when he tried to...
Oh, my, come on. It's just like we've talked about 100 times. They've been back and forth and back and forth. Either he's working all the time and never at home, or she's working all the time and never at home. And you've even said many times how good she is to him and everything. And she's been good to him and good to him and good to him over the years. And then suddenly this is going to be like a... No. He didn't.
He tried to call her and set an appointment to go out to dinner with her, and she couldn't make time for him. Michelle, they've had lapses where they weren't there for each other.
Mike, if you have an affair, you have to own that affair and not put the guilt and the blame onto somebody else. You have to own it, regardless of anything.
Yes.
In a marriage, that's it.
Yes. And it's not because of anything.
Exactly.
Because he did what he did.
I think part of the reason he blurts it out too, which was kind of unusual, is that this is kind of his psychology problem, right? It's like he shouldn't blurt it out like this. He just slaps her in the face with it.
Right, but that was one thing. But then him going, "Because," I couldn't listen to that. It disgusted me with him. And I think that probably has tainted maybe my view of him in this whole at least episode and maybe even beyond. But don't turn it on her. That is so weak.
So just, for him to say, "I had an affair," what if he said it logically? What would be the best way to say it, different than how he did say it?
This has happened to me in real life, so it's really hard to discuss, but you cannot blame, you can blame your marriage problems, but not in that moment when you're confessing the affair. You can't say, "Oh, it's because it's just offloading your guilt."
I completely agree.
So if somebody tells me they have an affair on me, against me, whatever, I want to know why. I probably want to know why.
But Mike, that's not why. There's not one reason why. No. And that's not why. And for him to say that, it was an excuse. That wasn't why. The why is because something's broken. And it's not mm-hmm. just one thing like this. You know, you weren't there. He should have told her. What he found time to tell her when he wanted to tell her, when he made it a priority to tell her about his illness, he did it. And her reaction was perfect. We even talked about it. She couldn't have been better than she was. And for him to use that, it was despicable.
All right. Well, he does call their marriage broken. And Joni runs up and sees this, the little daughter, Joni. And that was a commercial break. And I made a point of noticing that this episode now was half over. This might be the last episode we ever watched. And I was thinking, this is half over now. How the hell are they going to resolve enough of this to make it satisfying? I was really worried. And then this was actually the commercial break with the cool Walking Dead scene. So,
are you going to podcast The Walking Dead?
I don't plan to because there's so many other people doing Walking Dead podcasts.
They're not doing Fear the Walking Dead, though, all of them.
Well, yeah, I think they probably will. I think anyone doing a Walking Dead podcast will probably do a Fear the Walking Dead.
Oh, I suppose so.
I think he should do it too, Christine.
Why don't you and Christine do it, Michelle?
Well, we might.
At least we wouldn't have an affair.
All right, we come back to Mutiny, and the coffee maker's broken. Coffee maker's not working. And Cameron's in there early, and Donna's in there early. Donna tells now Cameron the results of this fight she had with Gordon. And Cameron tries to relate, but she doesn't know marriage, and starts to offer minimal comic relief, along with some pretty good philosophy, Michelle. Like, life, sometimes you have signs and you need to do stuff to change your life, and moving to California might be the diesel sub sign that we need to do. If we can't get the diesel sub to come here, let's go to the diesel sub. I don't know. It's a pretty good little analogy from this normally goofy Cameron, who's kind of helping Donna here, I think.
Yeah, I kind of waffled back and forth on that. Let me tell you what I thought. I thought Cameron was being supportive. And then I thought, is she using Donna's situation with Gordon to try to manipulate her into doing what she wants her to do? And I never really could understand, because Cameron, above everything, is not, well, she's had her moments of being a heavy manipulator, but normally she's pretty just up front. And I really wasn't sure if she was almost taking on a Joe role in the manipulation. You didn't think so?
No, that takes away from all of – because you could see Donna's the light going on over her head, like, oh, yeah. That was where she's formulating this idea that they have a lot of money and they could pay for this network server.
Well, yeah, but I don't know if it's a good idea yet. You know, we don't know if this is even going to work.
That's business. That's the magic of the story. Like, it's not a for sure thing. It's a risk, but you can see Donna thinking, the light going on as she's listening to Cameron, and also the rain outside is just really symbolic of this transition that they're going to be going through. Rain pattering on the windows outside. All right, so Gordon goes to Joe, just like Joe went to Gordon. Gordon goes over to Joe and hands him the Tabula Rasa software, the fix for the Sonaris virus.
Yeah, the blank slate.
Yeah. Hey, do you guys think, what's your philosophy on tabula rasa? Tabula rasa in philosophy is like every baby is born with a totally blank slate, and it's the world that fills their mind up with their prejudices and loves and hates and everything, versus you're kind of pre-programmed with what you're going to like and what you're going to dislike in life. How do you guys feel about that?
I think every child is born with a clean slate. Unless, obviously, it's got a, you know, predispositioned illness or something, then I think, you know, we teach them. The world teaches us.
How are you, Michelle?
I lean toward that way of thinking. Yeah, I think some things are genetically, I don't know, just like genetically maybe pre-programmed, but I'm not sure how far that carries on into personalities and stuff like that. I know Very recently, Christine, I've lost a family member, and so I was around a bunch of, you know, extended family that I, you know, haven't seen in a long time, and it was really, really interesting to me, in kind of an observer's point of view, to see these nieces and on down and distant cousins and stuff. And we all have so many of the same mannerisms and stuff like that. Like, they will remind you of, like, your own child or something. And there's no way that they have ever even been around this person, but they have a lot of the same mannerisms and stuff. So that's why I see the nature part and not just the nurture, maybe. But I'm not sure as it relates to what we're talking about here.
But that's just because genetically they're linked.
Yes, yes, exactly. Exactly. That's what I'm talking about. But isn't it funny how people will have the same mannerism? It's not even just a look necessarily, but almost like a mannerism, even though they've never even been around one another. I just think it was the coolest thing to observe kind of from a distance.
Well, they say like baby boys will pick up guns, toys in a room, and the girls will pick up the dolls and the flowers, and you know, it is kind of interesting.
I disagree. They play with whatever they want. If you give them a gun, or if you give them a truck, you call them truck, we call them cars, lorries, they'll play with it. If you give them a doll, they'll play with it, boy or girl. It's only as they get older that we teach them then. We'll stop a little boy from playing with I don't know what you call them, a pushchair, a stroller. We'll stop him from playing with a doll, and yet we wouldn't stop him from playing with, say, Ken from Abby and Ken, because we think that was a boy thing. But most little boys that I know will willingly, up until the age of 3 or 4, play with dolls and things. They don't know they're a boy or girl then.
Yeah, I've seen things though where like if you fill a room with toys, hammers and guns and dolls and pretty things, like boys tend to pick up the tools and the girls tend to pick without instruction and without discouragement or being steered into one or the other. I don't know, maybe it's just random, but
it's certainly interesting to think about it though.
Why do you think they named the software Tabula Rasa? Why do you think they named it that way?
Clean slate.
Yeah, it's a clean slate to fix the problem.
You don't think there was a more of a philosophical, like, just
oh,
this
you
puts...
mean the writers?
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. I'm sure there was more to it.
Like it fixes the slate between Joe and Gordon.
And it fixes. We're trying to go for a clean slate between Donna and Gordon, and you know. I guess almost between Joe and Sarah. I mean, a divorce is a clean slate-ish in a way. And I mean, in many, many different interactions.
Or Joe and Wheeler, yeah. So Gordon doesn't even realize he has lightning in a bottle here. He is really like Steve Wozniak. He has all these technical skills, but he needs the Steve Jobs to steer it in the right direction.
Wasn't that the coolest thing? I'm sorry, Christine.
No, I think that. Of their characters while watching it. I think of Steve Jobs and Wozniak.
Yeah, Wozniak. Yeah, it's a pretty cool analogy. And then Gordon reminds Joe that he's a good man, but he makes it hard for others to appreciate it, which is really a pretty good description of Joe. He's a decent guy, but he fucks up and he gets in his own way and he screws up other people and he creates this image of him as being just this evil guy. But anyway, this software eradicates and inoculates. It takes away the badness and it prevents future versions of that virus from hurting any computer that they put it on.
It is the first virus protection ever made for a computer. You know, that's what they're talking about. And it is the coolest thing to see it and see how it happened. And Gordon, it happens just with Gordon trying to make up for what he inadvertently did when he destroyed the software, or yeah, and so it's just I just thought it was really a light bulb moment for me even watching that, and I loved that scene.
I liked how it proved that they have a good friendship too. Like I wanted Joe and Gordon to have this friendship that it appears that they really do have.
Well, had anyway.
Well, I think they still do.
I don't know. Gordon was pretty mad at the end, maybe. I don't know.
Do you think Joe's connection to Sarah is like a mirror for Gordon and Donna?
Like, I think it's more the mirror for Cameron and Tom is what I've seen. But I think that's what Gordon's seeing. I think Gordon wants Joe to try to work things out with Sarah because he kind of feels like Sarah was Joe's calming influence and Sarah was Joe's, I don't want to say muse, but for lack of knowing how to put it better. And I think that's how he views Donna. And so he wants relationships to work out and he wants, you know, the happy ending with the couple.
Yeah, but isn't that what, I mean, that's kind of the mirror for him and Donna. Like, you can't find people like this all the time in life. And when you do, you should figure out how to work it out.
Oh,
he's really talking to himself in the mirror saying, get your shit together with Donna.
Absolutely.
Because you're never going to find a woman like her again.
Absolutely.
So his words to Joe are really to himself. But then Joe's light bulb goes on like Donna's light bulb went on. His eyes just kind of widen and he thinks, wow, here's an idea formulating in my head that, you know, you offer the disease, then you offer the cure.
Yep.
Well, it was pretty cool. So what about this next scene, Michelle? Boz is meeting with his kid, James, with his bosses and James's bosses. What did you think of this scene?
I thought it was a great scene. It took me a minute or two to... I actually went back and watched this a couple times. Boz is back schmoozing in a corporate situation again. And he's just at a manager level, but they're kind of promising him or insinuating that he's going to be moved up. And they're even thanking his son for bringing him in. And then one of the other guys starts to tell a story about being in the black. And I didn't know if Boz was going to, like, have a heart attack or stroke the way they showed the scene, because it was like a ringing in his ears where he couldn't hear anything anymore. But I think that was his fed up moment. I don't want to do this anymore.
Yeah, that was the light bulb going on for him. So it was like, wow, I gave the corporate joke, everyone laughed. Now I'm forced to listen to the corporate joke, which Boz's joke, by the way, was way funnier than this doofus's joke. But he realizes, wait a minute, I've been here before and I don't want to be here again. That was his light bulb going on.
Yeah.
But it was cool that they used that sonic dissonance, like when they found out Gordon was sick and like when Walter White found out he had the cancer. And it's this cool sonic dissonance that tells him he's really elsewhere. You know, he's not really quite there in that moment. So next we see this cool montage of Donna and Cameron looking out the window and thinking and looking around and kind of weighing their decision, weighing the change that's coming up upon them. Mm-hmm. And Gordon comes into Mutiny all frantic looking for Joni, and Donna gets the news that Joni's missing, and then we get a break.
And in that break, we noticed that Better Call Saul was nominated for 7 Emmys, and I know you and Jamie, y'all have arguably the best podcast on Better Call Saul, so if anybody hadn't seen that or listened to that, it's still time to catch up.
Sorry, well, which one? Which one, Michelle?
Better Call Saul. Jamie and Mike did Better Call Saul, which is like a spinoff from Breaking Bad. You got lots of TV to catch up on, Christine. You're going to love this. I promise. I wouldn't steer you wrong.
I get it. I listen to The Bold Move guys, Game of Thrones and other ones. And they're always banging on about Breaking Bad, Better Call Saul. And I just think, you've overkilled it for me. You're just always going on about it. Every program, it doesn't compare to Breaking Bad. And I don't know.
I promise.
Yeah, that's advice that you probably won't disagree with, Christine, when you listen to it.
Probably.
All right, so they come back. They're looking for Joni. Gordon wants to stress with Donna that it's not his illness that got Joni lost, that she ran away purposefully. And Haley, you know, Haley told him that and all that. It wasn't that he just left her somewhere and it's not his illness to blame.
I felt kind of sorry for him there. Because he felt very, very motivated to make her know that this wasn't his fault. And I don't know if she believed it wasn't.
Well, he's really desperate for her to stay with him. All this stuff with Joe and this advice about don't lose the one special woman. And he really feels that for Donna. But Joni's just camping out back. No big deal. She's got the, yep. I mean, who wouldn't look in the little dollhouse the first place?
I know.
They have a little hut. Christine, a little playhouse in the back, and they don't look there. And that's where she is. So they find her. She's fine. And they say, go run inside and order pizza. We're going to be in a minute. And then they have a little talk. Donna and Gordon have their talk in the little playhouse, which was interesting, to make such big decisions about their future in the little tiny playhouse, the toy house almost. It was an interesting contradiction.
Yeah, as parents, sometimes you find really weird places just to have a little bit of privacy.
So what did you think of the offer? Donna's offer to Gordon is, here's the deal. She lays down the law that you got to buy the server. You got to move to California. You got to help Mutiny put it together. You, in fact, have to become an employee of Mutiny. What did you think of that deal, Michelle?
I thought it was the best she could do. I thought it was, I thought the idea was good. I didn't like the delivery. I didn't like her telling him you have to. I think Gordon would have done it anyway. And I didn't like her, you know, telling him this is the price that you have to pay to try to fix everything.
Yeah, he even asks, is this blackmail?
Yeah.
Gordon's not going to be happy doing this. This is the exact opposite of what happens in season one, where Donna says, I know you have to do this. I'll support you, even though I don't really want to. If you do your half of the deal, which is the family part, it's almost like the opposite of this. It's stealing away his freedom and making him do something. And he does it because he has no choice. He doesn't choose to do it. He has no choice. If he doesn't do it, she's going to leave him.
Yeah, I think she's trying to rein him in a little bit because I think she worries about his business-making decisions and stuff based on very, accurate information that she's been given about his condition. So I think she wants him to be close to her so that she can keep an eye on stuff, number one. But I just didn't like the way she made it at a cost. I didn't like that.
Well, it's a risk. I mean, do you think it's a good risk to spend all their money on this? If Christine, you watched episode one of season two, Gordon got the big check for $600,000 or $800,000.
This is $869,000, was it, or something?
This is going to cost him all of that money to buy this server and move to California and work for Mutiny. They have to buy this big server for almost all the money they have.
Why are they going to California? Because Joe's there.
No, because that's where the server is, and that's probably the best environment for a company like Mutiny.
Okay.
It's the Silicon Valley. It's where Apple is, and Silicon Valley, all the computer developers. And
it's where Cameron's wanted to go for a long time. Cameron wanted to be in California, so.
But it is extortion. It is do this or else other bad things will happen. And still no abortion talk, by the way. There's still no communication about that. So next we see Joe goes back to this venture capital guy that calls him a psychopath and made him do the little song and dance, and he plays the Mutiny, or not the Mutiny, but the Sonaris virus and then the cure for it. I thought it was a little hard to believe, Michelle, that this guy would trust him to let him in and walk right up to his computer and put a disc in it.
But he would have had to have I think the guy wasn't expecting it, and he would have had to have literally physically stopped him in the circumstance. I kind of thought that too, but the way it played out, I thought it was believable. I thought it could have happened.
So he puts the virus in the guy's computer. It starts to create the problem again, that the same problem that Jacob Wheeler had. And then the guy panics, and Joe says, well, you need security, you need a fence, and he puts the repair disc in, and the guy sees immediately that, wow, this is pretty impressive, and essentially agrees to give Joe $10 million to start this Macmillan Utilities company, this computer virus prevention company, this computer security company. And Joe says security is trusting no one, which I thought also was pretty philosophical, that You can't go through life trusting no one, but that is probably a good way to maintain security. But there's somewhere in the middle, there's got to be a trade-off, right? You got to trust some people.
Well, yeah. That's, you know, Joe's probably talking about himself more than anybody else, because everybody who's ever trusted Joe ends up getting it. So
Joe tries to get Gordon involved next. He calls Gordon right from the lobby of this venture capitalist company, catches Gordon at dinner with the kids and with Donna eating that pizza that they just ordered after they made their plan to go to California. And Gordon tells him he's joined Mutiny, and Joe hangs up on him angrily. So that's the proof that Joe...
But this is Gordon's program. He has... And I know that it's not just this program, but this antivirus is what Gordon... It's what Gordon created. And essentially, Joe kind of stole that.
Didn't steal it if you offer the... He could rewrite it, Michelle. He could say, okay... For every virus, let's rewrite a program that prevents the virus from hurting the computer. That's the idea. It's not that one program.
No.
They even make a point of saying this will only work for this one virus. So they know they're going to have to write new software to protect from other viruses.
Absolutely. But the idea of being able to do that is Gordon's.
The idea is Joe's.
Gordon did it. It was his idea because he did it. And then he gave it to Joe.
It's not his idea to make a business out of it, though, where you sell that to people.
But
that's
he gave
a difference.
That to Joe to make up with Sarah and fix things with Jacob. He didn't give it to him to do that. I don't know. I don't know that it's, you know, like this big problem, but I think ethically it certainly is a problem. Just
no,
to take that
he offers it. He offers him to be involved in it. He says, no, I've got other things going on.
It's a 30-second conversation. He doesn't even tell him what it's about. He doesn't say, hey, I took what you gave me, and I've got a huge business coming up out of that now.
I think he did enough. I think he offered enough, and then he found out he's going to join.
I completely disagree.
Okay. But the inventing the software and creating the business are two totally separate things.
Agree with that, but I mean that is their relationship. Gordon is the inventor of the software and Joe is the creator of the business, so I still think Gordon should have a part of that or something. It should have at least been offered to him and told what he was doing with it.
It was offered to him. If somebody invents a wheel and another person takes that wheel and puts two axles and a car on top of it, that car is a new thing. Joe's idea is a new thing, to sell this idea to companies as the security for viruses. That's not Gordon's invention. Gordon invented the wheel. He didn't invent the car. And Joe still said, hey, this is something we should both work on together. And Gordon doesn't want to do it.
But he didn't tell him what it was. He didn't say, this is something we should work on together.
Even if he told him what it was, he still wouldn't have changed anything.
I don't know if it would have or not. But the point is that he took Gordon's physical disc and turned it into a business. And I think on some level, that is at the very least unethical.
But he's been doing that from the beginning.
Yes, thank you. Yes, he has. That's his MO. That's what he does. But it's frustrating to me that he did that. And why would Gordon have been so mad at the end if he didn't feel ripped off too?
Well, that's an interesting question, because Gordon, I think, is kind of probably mad at Donna because now he's roped into this deal where he has to go to California and be part of Mutiny. He's missing out. Gordon wants his own business, Michelle. He's always wanted it. Donna let him have it in season one after Symphonic failed, and he was very thankful for it. He wants it. He started his own computer business. He wants his own business. That's how he's going to flourish.
But
if Donna stops him from...
At Donna about
because
that.
She's stopping him from doing it. You have to work for Mutiny.
But she's only trying to do what she feels like is the...
Her intentions are good. I agree with that. But she's...
He can't be mad at her. That was his choice to do that.
No, it wasn't. That was his choice to join Mutiny and go to California?
Of course it was.
No, it was her ultimatum.
It was an ultimatum, but he still had a choice.
Well,
he didn't have
at
to do
what
that if he
at
didn't
what cost
do it.
His family would have broken up. It was a no choice choice. It was like, okay, you don't have to do it. You're not going to get a gun to your head, but you're not going to have this family anymore.
Okay, Mike, but if we really want to do that, we have to go back farther than that, too, and say that she gave him that ultimatum because of the affair and the situation that they were in. So then it's really his fault. Then,
okay.
I mean, you know, we can.
Gordon's not going to be happy working for Mutiny while this other business that Joe's starting goes on in California right next to them, Daly City, and the picture of Joe choosing this office, that's South Bay, that's Daly City. They're neighbors. They're going to be neighbors, and Gordon's going to be forced to watch McMillan Utilities thrive. Whether or not Mutiny thrives, Mutiny is not Gordon's idea.
No, I agree. And Gordon should be part of Joe's business. I agree with all of that. I'm just saying, he can't blame Donna for that. And if he does, that's going to be the downfall.
Well, he's going to be resentful of Mutiny and having to be part of Mutiny and choosing because of Donna's way she posed that option to him. He's going to be resentful. I mean, Joe's business of McMillan Utilities should be Gordon and Joe's business of Gordon and Joe's, you know, software security.
Absolutely.
Should be their business, but it's not because of these other factors. So anyway, we see Cameron now talk to Tom. She walks right into his house. There are a lot of people walking into the front doors of other people's houses without knocking, including Mutiny, including Tom's house. That's a pretty bold move, isn't it? She doesn't knock. She walks into his front door of his house.
That didn't happen here. Not where I live.
And she gives Tom this plane ticket to go to California. Whether or not you want to be in with the company, come anyway. It's a free plane ticket, but the plane leaves in, what, 4 hours? It leaves that night. So he has to decide whether he's going to just leave and up and go to California from Dallas. And
is Joe jealous of Tom?
Yes, I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think Joe loves Cameron.
Yeah, I do too.
I think so. You got married pretty quick, though.
Yeah, out of defense, I think. Out of, like, I'll throw myself into this and I won't have to think about not having Cameron.
Yeah, well, maybe, but you'll have to kind of judge that relationship for yourself, Christine, between he and Sarah. He acts like he is head over heels for Sarah. So
I've seen it. He looks as if he likes
it. It's forced, though. It's never magical. It's forced.
I don't know.
I think he's convinced himself that Sarah would be good for him, but I think it's forced. I just don't believe it.
Maybe he just wanted to feel normal when he left Cardiff Electrics, that he wanted to just feel normal. And when he met Sarah then, everything that he thought that he could be to conform. You know, most people try to conform to what we should do, you know. You know, see someone, get engaged, get married, get a job, do this, do that, raise a family, build, you know, make a house and everything together. So we all conform. And if you don't conform, you're seen as different, aren't you?
Well, that's a really good point. And also the point that there's people sometimes that you might be really attracted to, like he is to Cameron, but you just know that relationship is going to do nothing but cause harm, maybe.
Yeah, because Cameron is a rebel. I mean, obviously, calling the company Mutiny, you know, Mutiny is a criminal activity for a start. But in Cameron, I think he sees a younger him.
I agree.
You know, he sees Cameron's dreams and, you know, he admires Cameron for a vision.
Absolutely. Yeah, they're the male and female sides of the same coin.
Yeah.
So they all get on the plane but that's a really good question though, just not to leave that hanging. Does Joe love Cameron? That's way more important than the technology features of this show. Those keep it topical and interesting in the mid-80s, but the real story is who's connecting with who personality-wise and romantically and all that.
I definitely think Joe loves Cameron.
Yeah, me too.
I do too.
Mm. Well, we all agreed on something.
Hey, we all agreed on one thing. I'm so happy.
So they all get on this plane. Everyone's going to California as the Talking Heads play Heaven. The girls look happy. Boz looks happy. Buzz
comes walking on. That was cool. Weren't you happy?
He throws a pretty misogynist slam on everybody, though. Like, let's go to California, ladies. Like, that wasn't cool, was it? You lady, what do you ladies think of that?
Well, someone's saying, let's go to California, ladies.
Yeah, to a bunch of dudes, essentially.
Oh, guys do that.
Oh, yeah. That's like when builders and workmen rib each other.
Yeah, that was a rib. That was a poke.
It's a rib, but it's, I don't know. All right, if you guys are, if you're okay with it, I'm okay with it.
Yeah, that was very Southern, I think, too. You know, and there's, of course, from Texas. I think that's very common.
Boz with the big black cowboy hat.
Yeah, the black
I think
one.
It's just I think it's just very generic anyway. Just general ribbing of how guys are.
Yeah, it's very colloquial. It's a friendly jibe. Like, okay, ladies, I see you guys are tough enough to do this. Let's go for it.
Yeah, I agree.
So, Christine, the deal is that Cameron's invited Tom, and everyone's on the plane. They show them loading on the plane, all the mutiny people, all the, you know, Cameron and Donna and Gordon and the kids, and then Boz shows up. So what about Tom? Is he going to make it? Is he going to show up? So time ticks by. Then they shut the door on the plane, and there's no Tom. And Gordon turns to Donna and says, hey, this is our new chance. I'm glad we're taking this shot. You know, maybe we can even have a new baby. The girls look happy. Maybe we can have a new baby in California. And Donna just excuses herself and goes to the bathroom and cries. And I just think, I mean, the way this is set up, if we can see what happens to these people, I don't think Gordon and Donna have a chance. Michelle, what do you think? If there is a season 3, where would you put Gordon and Donna?
Well, I hadn't even thought, like you just said, excuse me, about Gordon resenting Donna over the Joe thing. I wouldn't even think that would have anything to do with his relationship with Donna. But especially since you threw that into the mix and all that's kind of washed up in there now, I think that they are really going to have a hard time. I think they can. I'm ever optimistic on marriage and relationships and stuff like that. So I think they can, but I think that it's going to be a rough road.
Yeah, what's Gordon going to think after all this if, like, 2 months later they're in California and he finds out, you know, Donna doesn't want another baby and that she's had an abortion? Why didn't you tell me this back when
I don't know that Donna doesn't want another baby. I just know that at that time, Donna could not handle another baby.
Maybe.
You can't put a Band-Aid on, you know, they call them Band-Aid babies. If you have a baby to try and save your marriage, it's called a Band-Aid baby. And you can't put a Band-Aid on a marriage.
Yeah, those babies are born with a job, I think is what Dr. Phil says. They have a job of fixing your marriage, you know.
Yeah, and if and invariably fails.
Maybe if we do get to see season 3, that'll be something that they can struggle over and overcome, and it'll bring them even closer.
Right.
But I kind of think they're doomed if they do make it to season 3. And I think Cameron and Tom now have to be doomed. This is the second time they've had a pretty substantial split. Tom not showing up for this plane is not a good sign for Cameron and Tom.
Well, that leaves it open then for Cameron and Joe.
That's right. That's again. What I thought too. Right.
Gordon reads about the McMillan utility on the magazine, the airplane magazine, and the $10 million. And I just put in my notes, it's too bad we're not going to see any of this because I'm fearful that they're just going to not have this episode, not have this show again renewed, which I think they should. I hope they do, but I'm kind of doubtful that they will.
Oh, I hate it when shows get canceled.
Me too.
This isn't the very end of this episode. They do go to the Bay Area in San Francisco. Joe's office is awesome, by the way. Very a la Mad Men, where he stands in the framework of the building, and it's this huge empty room, just like the Mad Men people did when they moved into their new building.
Yeah.
And a cool scene of San Francisco in the background, the Transamerica Tower and the Bay Bridge, and you know, it's reminding us that Halt and Catch Fire was a replacement show for Mad Men. It reminded me anyway. And I also loved about the real estate deal that it was a big deal. It was this building, Christine, that Joe's moving into that houses 100 desks. So it's this big, huge office space. Mm. And the real estate lady just says, you don't need to discuss price? Okay, I'll just go get the paperwork. And it was – they talked, what, two lines, Michelle. She walks off to get the paperwork, and Joe makes that decision like a snap of a finger that I'll take it. I'll take this office space. Putting him right next to Daly City, like I said, they're going to be neighbors with Mutiny, McMillan Utility and Mutiny.
Why would Joe have went there to do this? He didn't have to do that there.
Because it's Silicon Valley. It's the place to be for – he's got to hire programmers for writing all this virus protection.
So you think that it was for that reason alone, or do you think it was also because he knew that Mutiny was going to California as well?
Maybe. I mean, he does know that Mutiny's going to California. But realistically, to make sense with the technology of what he's going to need, he's going to need 100 writers, programmers, coders. He's going to need to find them.
It just makes business sense, but it also almost felt like a little jab to me.
Or a plot. I'm next to you. Right. You know, Christopher Cantwell and Christopher, the two guys who wrote this show are named Christopher. That's very smart. They're very smart in setting up every reason to have a season three. So, you know, they want a season three, and they want to convince people who make decisions about this program that they should have a season three. And they drop all these hints, like Donna and Gordon, what's going to happen with them, Tom and Cameron, Boz and the new job. Mm-hmm. Joe and Gordon, you know, hints of Apple. We see these magazine covers with Steve Jobs, and, you know, moves right into Steve Jobs' neighborhood there in California. All this California stuff, it's like they're setting up pretty wisely every reason to have a season three. So it's just up to the decision makers as to whether or not we'll actually see it.
It'd be a shame if it got canceled then.
Right, Christine, especially after you jammed in 12 episodes in, what, three days?
So I could listen to the podcast. I'm a podcast junkie. I listen to audio. I listen to about 15 podcasts a week.
Oh, wow.
Well, I can't go to sleep without something on.
We do 15 podcasts a week. Seems like it anyway.
It does sometimes, yeah.
Oh, you must do Fear the Walking Dead.
Well, maybe comment on it here and there, but I don't see a regular podcast for it.
Yeah, but Halt's going to finish. You watch Orange is the New Black, don't you? Is that finished?
No. Well, we've kind of hiatus. Orange is the New Black. We may be picking it back up, but we're not actually doing that one right now.
Michelle, I actually see that differently than you do. That's your job. Mm-hmm. Orange is the New Black is for you. You've hiatus.
And I have hiatus.
No, I hate, not hiate, hate. I hate Orange is the New Black. I don't like Orange is the New Black as much as when I first started watching it.
I've watched two seasons, and I got fed up of it. I just thought, oh, I can't do this. I prefer Banshee and all of that.
Yeah, Banshee's good. It's hard to do podcasts in the past, though. Yeah, it's hard to go back and do podcasts. As far as people, you know, it's fun to do them, but people won't listen to them, I don't think, as much. Mm. All right, so that's it for Halt and Catch Fire. Hopefully not forever. Hopefully we'll see some new action in season three.
I got to tell you, I think they ended it as good as they could have ended it, maybe, without wrapping it up. They left just enough open that I want to know what else is going to happen, but if not... it was at least kind of a hopeful ending. I don't know. What did you think, Mike?
They did that with season one. They ended it not knowing if they had a season two.
I'm just gonna say that.
And the truck burning was kind of a pretty fitting ending if it wouldn't have been picked up again.
Yeah.
And I think that this is sort of a satisfactory ending, but there's still a lot of questions that it's going to be hard to not have answered if they don't pick it up.
But how hard would that be to write every year, you know, season to season in these, 10 episodes and having to end it like that? So I got to give them credit because that would have to really stifle your creativeness to have to end it in some way that people didn't just end up hating the show. So
it's pretty skillful writing that they have to end it satisfactorily and hopefully that so that they can get it. I mean, that's their jobs. That's their career. They want it to keep going on.
Sure.
So they want to create new story interest, but they need to end it too at the same time.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think they did a pretty good job of balancing the two.
I do too.
So it's all part of West Coast Project. At Scathing Tweets is my Twitter. Michelle, what's yours?
At Michelle from TN.
And Christine from Wales, what's yours?
At Cute Poison 10.
At Cute Poison 10. So we'll put those in the show notes. And unless you guys have anything else for Halt and Hatch Fire, that's it.
Let's go to Lukenbach, Texas, Waylon and Willie and the boys. This successful life we're living got us feuding like the Hatfields and McCoys. Between Hank Williams' pain songs and Newberry's train songs and Blue Eyes crying in the rain. Out in Lukenbach, Texas, ain't nobody feeling no pain. So baby, let's sell your diamond ring, buy some boots and faded jeans and go away. This coat and tie is choking me, and in your high society you cry all day. We've been so busy keeping up with the Joneses, four-car garage, and we're still building on. Maybe it's time we got back to the basics of love. Let's go to Lukenbach, Texas, Waylon and Willie and the boys. This successful life we're living got us feuding like the Hatfields and McCoys. Between Hank Williams' pain songs and Newberry's train songs and Blue Eyes crying in the rain. Out in Lukenbach, Texas, ain't nobody feeling no pain.
Let's go to Lukenbach, Texas, Willie and Waylon and boys. This successful life we're living's got us feuding like the Hatfields and the boys. Between the Hank Williams pain songs and Jerry Jeff train songs and Blue Eyes crying in the rain. Out in Lukenbach, Texas, there ain't nobody feeling no pain.